This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Right now is a busy time in the garden, harvesting what you planted this spring and planning for the fall. And the heat and humidity lately is creating some challenges for gardeners. So what should you plant now? How should you be getting your garden ready for the fall? And what can you do to keep your plants from being damaged by insects and disease? Here to answer your gardening questions, our co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Huttinger, and Boone County Cooperative Extension Horticulture Agent David Kester. You can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And David and Peter, good to see both of you. Thank you for being here today.
Good to be here.
Yeah. David, what should gardeners be doing right now? What should be on their checklist?
Just really going out and monitoring things. I think we've had, obviously, humid weather, wet weather, which has brought on a lot of diseases. So we're seeing a lot of that. And one of the things that even without all the rain that we've had, I like to supplement fertilizer a little bit right now. Nitrogen especially is the one that you want to look for. But all that rain has maybe leached some of the nitrogen out of the soil. And it's a good time to maybe replenish some of that. Just give your plants, Mark, we tell people all the time, a healthy plant is much more disease resistant than one that is nutrient stressed. So let's go ahead and fertilize those a little bit. And you can certainly use organic blood meal, fish emulsion. Those are all great high nitrogen sources, and by all means, use those.
What kind of diseases are we talking about, David?
Boy, we've had, just on vegetables, we've had blossom end rot. That's not a disease, but it's a nutrient deficiency brought on by the weather, and calcium deficiency. But we've had early blight, bacterial wilt, bacterial spot. I've had several different tomatoes out of the plot that we have that have had some Pythium and some Rhizoctonia. And so we've had our share of different things. And also we're seeing bacterial canker on some of the tomatoes that we've had. So a lot of things are showing up just because really mainly due to the wet conditions.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what's on your list to do for this time of year?
Well, I think one of the things we talk about the problems with fungal and bacteria diseases, one thing that's important is basically hygiene, particularly your tomatoes. Hopefully you haven't planted them too close together. Take off the lower limbs so you have good air movement underneath them. Mulch, weed, and a light mulch can also be helpful in that case. Also, because we've had so much humidity, try not to use sprinklers and overwatering the plants, meaning up from the top. If you have soaker hoses or you're watering with a hose or a watering can, try and go underneath the plants when watering. And that should really kind of help a lot. And also even like having water splash the soil and splash up on the plant can, bring fungal and bacterial diseases up into the plant. So just be cautious.
How do you know how much water is appropriate? I mean, how do you know how much is, if it's
you
getting
measure,
too much or
I mean, really, too the best thing is to get a rain gauge or even just put out a tin can. And when you've got an inch of rain, you measure that with a ruler. If an inch of rain has occurred during that week, you've gotten enough. And if not, you better supplement a little bit. And, of course, you want to empty that in between. But I always tell gardeners who are really, want to know what's going on, buy yourself an inexpensive rain gauge. They're $2, $3, $4 a piece. And it's really kind of fun because, I've told people so often that I will be in my garden out in Morning View, Kentucky, and I'll be listening to the Reds game as I'm working in my garden, and there'll be a rain delay at Riverfront or down at the stadium, and yet in my garden it's completely dry and has been for quite some time. During the summer, especially this time of year, we get into a lot of spotty showers. And, I think, was it Mason County last night got 5 inches of rain? And I didn't get anywhere close to that. But that's pretty close to us here in northern Kentucky, or it is northern Kentucky. And they had floods and everything else there.
Yeah, and in southwestern Ohio, too, we have a lot of clay in the soil. So a lot of times the crust in your garden will look very dry. But you should stick your finger in there and probe. And if it goes down to your, second knuckle or something, If you start feeling moisture down there, you actually may still have some moisture there, so you don't want to overwater. Also, using a stirrupo or a hoe to kind of scrape that crust on the top of the soil creates kind of like a dust mulch, and that'll help retain moisture. But then also when you do get water or you water, that crust is broken and so that the water can readily enter the soil.
And what about insects? Disease is obviously a problem. Does this wet weather bring out insects as well?
It does. And we've got our usual Japanese beetles are prevalent. We've had flea beetles on eggplant. And we've had our host of ornamental plants that are seeing a lot of insect problems. And so, you know, we had a fairly mild winter. And so we had a lot of things that overwintered pretty well, and we've seen that. One of the questions or the calls that we're getting a lot of is ticks this year, and we really people who have pets need to be really diligent and you know treat their pets. And also, if you're out there in some tall weeds, come in and take a look at yourself because they're pretty prevalent out there, and we've seen them all the way through up until now.
513-419-7100 to join our conversation. And let's talk to Caroline in Claremont County. Hi, Caroline.
Hi. I have two quick questions. One is on my homegrown Blue Lake beans, some of the full-length beans have little tiny holes that almost look like they're right in a line, and they're just like it's 1-1-1-1-1. And what would cause that?
I was thinking bean leaf beetle, but I'm not sure. Yeah,
that's an interesting. I've never encountered like a little straight line.
Right.
They're just little dots, maybe, you know, a quarter of an inch apart, and there might be five on one of the beans. And it's happened on several of the beans.
Are you sure is it a dark spot or is it a...
Yes, it's a dark spot.
Okay, so it's not necessarily an insect.
Oh, okay.
And there are several different bean diseases that may look like that. We've seen a number of them this year. One of the things that you can do is in this day and age, it's really handy that if you can just put it on a white piece of paper and take a picture of it and then email that on into your extension office, and they can usually identify it that way.
Okay. And my other question is, I have never, ever been able to grow zucchini in Cincinnati. Everybody else can but me, I think. I get the plants grow nice and big. I get the blossoms, and the blossoms fall off. I have a summer squash and a zucchini. They're both bush varieties, and the blossoms just fall off and nothing happens.
I really don't. I can't figure that out because, I mean, there's an awful lot of things that can go wrong. You get squash vine borer, you get several different things. But the fact that they're just the early blooms on your squash plants are primarily male, and they will never set fruit. They are there just to serve as the pollen source for the female flowers, which will come on secondarily. But I'm just amazed that all of your blooms fall off like that. I can't.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
yeah,
you should be get. They should be. They are pollinated by insects. Bees should be working in there, and you should be getting fruit. And you know, I mean, I have seen cases where they will actually get pollinated. The fruit will come out, and then they will rot off. But you should be seeing some sort of fruit there first.
Well, on the one summer squash, I did have one squash that I took off. That was about a week ago. It was like, maybe 4 or 5 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
I took that off about a week ago. And since then, the blossoms, big, nice blossoms, and then they just fall off.
Are you planting the plants in mounds? Are they slightly elevated?
Yes, the zucchini is in a mound. The summer squash is not.
Okay, because I found that by putting them in mounds that that kind of really increases productivity because you get better drainage and there's, more air can move underneath the plant.
Usually we have the opposite problem where you're trying to find sources of getting rid of your zucchini. And I really cannot figure out why that's happening. Are you growing new good varieties and all that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay.
It's burpee.
Okay.
And yeah, in fact, we were so enthusiastic about our harvest that my husband made a little wire box that we're going to put out in our front yard saying free vegetables.
That's what did it.
But I don't think we're going to have that problem.
No.
Yeah.
The only other thing I was going to, are you fertilizing or?
I did initially. I haven't fertilized since.
Okay, so you're not over-fertilized. Okay.
Caroline, thank you.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Caroline, for the call. We appreciate it. Let's talk to Jan in Finneytown. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have some zucchini plants, and I've had really good luck with zucchini plants in the past, but this year they're doing really poorly. And at first I thought that I had a mold problem because I was getting like white fuzzy spots on the leaves. But then I was pulling off some of the dead leaves and branches just this morning, and I found some grubs.
Yes.
Doing a little bit of research, I found that those are the larvae of the squash vine borer.
Exactly.
And I'm wondering if you have any advice on how I can save my plants.
First of all, the you are getting mildew on your foliage, and that is really typical this year, and it's an issue, and it will shut down your plants. And one of the things that I always tell people is, you know, don't expect one zucchini plant or one planting of zucchini or squash to go through the entire summer. You need to plant zucchini and summer squash maybe is up to three different times during the season. Younger plants are much more disease resistant than older ones. So do that. That will help. And then...
I was going to say with the borer, there's a couple ways to spot it. One is that sort of at the stalk of the plant, you'll see a little powdery mound, a yellow mound. And then you can, where there's the hole, you can slit the stem lengthwise and spread it open and then dig the grub out. It's a white grub with a black spot on its head. And you sometimes it can be two or three. Then you close that back up and cover it up with compost or soil. And I've always found that there's better than a 50% chance the plant will survive. But the other thing, way to kind of spot is that these plants often, when it's really hot in late afternoon or in mid-afternoon even, they'll wilt down. And then they perk back up in the evening. But if you notice your leaves are wilting and not perking back up when it gets cool, or they're not perked up first thing in the morning, go and check all the bottoms of the stalks. But, you know, you can, as a preliminary thing, you can use BT spray, which is a certified organic. And what that does, it's toxic to the caterpillar itself. So when after the eggs hatch and the caterpillar is going down to the base of the plant, it'll kill it. Then there's also things like neem as a broad spectrum insecticide, but also can act as a fungicide and can help also with the different mildew problems.
I was just looking up information about that recently.
I'm sorry, you cut out for a second, so we didn't hear the...
Would a garlic spray be helpful?
I don't think it will on any of the... I'm not aware that it will do any good on mildew, and I don't know that garlic will do much for squash vine borer either.
Yeah. Well, with powdery mildew, I know there are certain things you can get make these safer soap mixtures. One of the things you put in is baking soda. Another one is milk. You can kind of look at those things. But for some of this other stuff, I mean, you really have to, you know, use something like neem oil or BT.
Jen, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
And we will continue our gardening conversation. You can join us 513-419-7100, or you can email your questions to talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us this afternoon to answer your gardening questions are co-owner of Home at Osong Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Huttinger, and Boone County Cooperative Extension Horticulture Agent David Kester. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Peter, you mentioned plants wilting, then perking back up after you get
some water. And we've had this intense, this combination of intense heat, water, humidity. Should you water at a point like that, or are you running into the risk of maybe giving them too much water at that point?
Well, you can overwater. I mean, like Dave was saying earlier, I mean, the rule of thumb is an inch of water, you know, a week. When I was talking specifically about, you know, like with squash, you know, zucchini, yellow crookneck, but also, you know, pumpkin and some things. So just as a defense against the heat, they kind of wilt down and it kind of provides more shade to protect the plant and the soil and stuff. And then when the weather gets cool, it's not moisture, it's when it becomes cool again, they perk back up.
Do raised garden beds do better in cases of extremely heavy rain, or do the sides just create a barrier that keeps the ground oversaturated?
No, raised beds are wonderful in wet years. They they're not as good in dry years, of course, because they drain so well. But in wet years, they're wonderful, and they're wonderful in the early spring part of the season where we tend to get more water than usual.
Yeah, when we water the raised wooden beds, we always tell people, like particularly like late July and during August, is to make sure you do a concentration of water around the outside edge, because the wood can actually act as a wick. But even you can build raised beds without a wooden box too. I always try and encourage people, like at the Price Hill Community Garden that we're developing. It's a half-acre site, and Joshua is building these beds that are 70 feet long. And 30 inches wide, but they're about, you know, 4 or 5 inches high. And so it's just a simple mound, but it's the same reason you're doing that heavy soil, and it provides some drainage.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation about gardening. You can also email us talk@wvxu.org. Let's talk to Lee in Independence. Hi, Lee.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I think that's what they're called. They have sort of a narrow body.
Excuse me, Lee, we lost a little bit of what you said. Can you back up and start again for us? Your phone cut out.
Sure, sorry. We keep having a problem with blister beetles. I think that's what they're called. They're sort of a long, slender body with gray with black stripes on them. And they make a mess. They don't really destroy too many of my greens, but they seem to be attracted to lamb's quarters. But do you have a solution? Is there a companion, a trap plant other than lamb's quarters that I can use? Or do you know what critter likes to eat those that, you know, I could attract?
Well, they're called blister beetles for a reason. And you probably know that if you squash them on your hand, they can, you know, raise a welt, and it's pretty uncomfortable. Blister beetles, when I've had some issues with them, I have found that they generally they attack in quantity. They will get on one plant and in mass, and they will defoliate that entire plant, and then they'll move on to the next one. And so what I have done is when they're on the one plant, I will pull that plant out, stick it in a black plastic or a plastic bag, and kind of cook them that way. And I have just found by reducing the quantity of numbers, I've been able to effectively get rid of them.
Yeah, I agree with Dave. Cool. Is that, you know, it's hard if you're a home gardener and you only have a couple plants, but if you have a larger space, you know, sometimes when I see a large congregation of things, I'll just put a plastic bag over the top of it, tie it at the bottom, pull out the plant, or else just pull out the plant or cut off a section of it and dunk all the insects in some water, in a bucket of water, and let them drown.
Oh, good idea. Okay, that's another trick I'll try then. We've tried insecticidal soap, but you're going to be standing there spraying all the time.
Right.
It's less effective with a beetle because of their shells. And
insecticidal soap just doesn't really give you much residual.
Right, you're right. Well, I like that idea. That's going to be my next move. Thank you so much.
All right.
Lee, thank you for the phone call. Let's talk to Larry in Butler County. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Thanks, gentlemen. I have two raised beds, 4 feet wide, 16 feet long. Each year I dig in fresh compost. But for the past 3 years, I think I mistakenly planted my tomato plants, about a dozen of them, in the same spot, in the same bed. Well, I have that black dot disease this year. The plants are half defoliated. next year, I'm going to put the tomato plants in another bed, but is there anything I can dig in or spray on the old bed to kill whatever's causing that black dot disease?
No, I think just adding compost in there and then rotating out of it, get away from there. And, of course, replant with something not in the tomato family. Don't go back with peppers, potatoes, or eggplant or tomatoes, and you should be okay. Green beans, squash, any of those will be okay. That won't transfer. And if you add organic matter, that seems to do pretty well. I don't know that I would necessarily – I mean, I think you could also – this fall, maybe put some rye in that bed and let that, and then turn that in the spring. That'll help. Another thing that you can do is I would, as Peter said, one of the things that I do for early blight, and it seems like that is so prevalent now that no matter what you do, you're going to end up with it, and it can really reduce your yield. But get plenty of air movement between those plants. I like to mulch, keep the rain from splashing. And then one of the things that I like to also do is maybe remove some of that lower foliage on those plants, because early blight will affect that it gets on those lower foliage quicker and faster, and then it just shoots right up the stem. It's awfully early in the season for you to be halfway defoliated on your tomatoes.
Is it sufficient if each year I rotate those tomato plants from one bed to the other? I only have two beds.
That's about all you can do. I mean, you know, we always, you know, you should be on a 4-year rotation. Well, that sounds good if you've got, you know, a quarter of an acre, but in your situation, you can only do the best that you can. I will tell you that there are fungicides that you can apply. Some of them, for instance, chlorothalonil only has a one-day or a no-day harvest restriction. You can also use copper as a fungicide. And one of the things that I will sometimes do, if I use those really early in the season, I really feel like it won't prevent me from getting that disease, but maybe it'll lengthen the time that I'm picking tomatoes into late August, September.
Well, also given the length of your beds, I mean, it's, you know, maybe just next year or so, bite the bullet a little bit, and maybe just on the one bed that you moved the tomatoes to is only plant half the bed. And then the following year, use the other half of the bed for the tomatoes. And I realize that's knocking you down to 3 to 4 tomato plants. But in the long run, it may allow the other bed to rejuvenate. And in terms of cover crops, I'm glad Dave brought that up, is Hamilton County Soil and Water Conservation District is selling a fall cover crop right now that you can buy for home, and it works really well for home gardeners. And it's a what you call a cocktail mix. So it's a mixture of root, vegetables, legumes, and some grasses. And this crop is really great, is that it dies back over winter. So in the spring, it's all dead material that you can then kind of chop up and turn into the soil, or else you can let it just lay as a mat on top of the soil and grow plants directly into it. So I would definitely recommend people to take a look at that. I've been using this cocktail mix for about 6 years now, and I'm really sold on it.
Larry, thank you for the phone call.
What benefit would that be? What benefit will the winter crop be?
Well, it provides it prevents erosion and provides more organic matter into your soil. But then also the legumes will fix, and the nodules on the roots will fix nitrogen into the soil. So it both feeds and protects the soil.
Larry, thanks so much for the call. Let's talk to Kathy in Beaver Creek. Hi, Kathy.
Garden.
Me too.
We had a beautiful, big, healthy tomato plant, and all of a sudden it just wilted. We thought, oh, it's getting too much rain. No. We checked. So we thought, okay, it needs more water. That didn't work. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. So I got online and looked, and you know, I think it has a bacterial something or other disease, and it said that there was nothing in the world you could do for it. It is caused by an injury to the plant. Have you ever heard of that?
Is it bacterial canker?
No, it didn't say anything about canker. This plant was green. It never turned yellow or brown. It was just as green as it could be when we finally pulled it out. It just went limp.
Mm-hmm.
There was no tests that I detected. Nothing. It just went limp.
We have had that on a few of our plants out at the plot that we're working in, and I think if you looked at the base of that, right where it goes into the stem, goes into the root system, you might find some discoloration there, and that's where any kind of an injury or your pruning, taking off suckers, it can really facilitate that particular disease. And I hadn't seen it too often before, but we had one variety this year out in our plot that was very susceptible to it. And we lost, 9 or 10 plants.
So picking off suckers, I may have injured it. I was wondering about that.
You can. I mean, that's a good way to spread it. It can be spread that way, but any kind of an injury to the base, and I don't think we didn't injure all these plants, but it's also the report that I got back on it. It's highly infectious.
Oh, huh. Well, I'm glad it was just one of those little yellow pear, and I didn't have room for it in the garden, so I put it in a huge pot.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone now,
yeah.
But I was wondering if it would be infectious.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was, I planted 3 sweet pepper, red, orange, and yellow. And do you know, they never got any bigger than when I planted them a couple of months ago, but a couple of them actually had fruit on them that was as big maybe as a small apple, but the actual plant never grew. I mean... So I pulled those out and bought more, but my son-in-law had the same problem. His plants never grew either.
One of the things that I have seen, if you buy transplants sometimes later in the year, and peppers are, I've seen this on peppers, when that root ball, they stay in that little plastic container for way too long. And then when you put them into the garden, they're fertilizing and liquid feeding as they're in that container. You bring them out, and sometimes those roots do not expand from where that little root ball is, and it can really stunt a plant. And if it has the fruit on it that it's set at the nursery, that's about all you're going to get off of it, and sometimes that will not get any bigger.
Yeah, often when I'm transplanting a plant, if it's at all root-bound, and ideally they never are, but you kind of tickle the edges of the roots so that some of the root fibers are radiating out from the center of the plant, and that can facilitate that. Also, if I get something with a blossom on it or a fruit when I transplant it, I pick them off, pinch them off.
Yeah.
And as a general rule, the first piece of fruit on a pepper, and I almost always just pinch it off.
Yeah. I think that's really good advice. I think you're attracted to a plant that, oh, it's got fruit on it. This will just all be that much earlier. But really, that fruit is stunning it somewhat initially, and you really want that plant to go into your garden, and the first thing you want it to do is to grow vegetatively, and then the flowers will come on second to that, and that'll give you long season production. But you can really stunt a plant when you put it out and it's when you buy it from the garden center and it has a lot of fruit on it.
Kathy, thank you so much. We appreciate the call. Nancy sent us an email and says that she thinks they may have used a compost that was exposed to an herbicide. I'm not sure if I'm saying this right. Aminopyralid? Does that sound familiar, David? Or
yeah, we've that is a it's frequently used in horse pastures or it is applied to kill some of the weeds in a pasture, and of course it can be eaten the the grass or whatever the legume is eaten by the horse, and then it passes through. And then if that manure is collected and not composted thoroughly, we have seen that herbicide coming back. And what you really see it on are tomatoes. Tomatoes are one of the first plants that will really show that up. If you're concerned about, well, something being in your garden, plant a tomato in there and it'll be the first thing to show it. But yeah, we have seen that happen.
And her question is it safe to eat tomatoes and beans and onions that are grown in that soil?
Onions would be probably the one most likely to accumulate that in the bulb area, the edible portion. It really depends on how the degree that it was affected by it. I have talked to specialists and they say, well, it would be minuscule, but you know, it's kind of a personal decision whether you want to, if you're comfortable with it. But I would really take a hard look at it and maybe, you know, go to a farmer's market and purchase this year, or talk with your extension office and just see what the status is, and maybe they can send that down and get a positive diagnosis on whether it is actually herbicide damage.
Yeah, another thing to just always remember about using animal manures, particularly horse, I think, is people often will get it from people who have stables and stuff, and it's really not, it may kind of look composted, but it's not really thoroughly composted. I think it's always a good idea to get, if you have the room, is to get the manure and keep it for at least 6 months before applying it to your garden. And if you can let it go through a season, particularly over winter, then in the spring it comes up, you can get an idea of what weed seed is in it. You can kind of remedy it by straining the soil early, and that'll kill those little weeds that are on top.
Yeah,
and then apply it to your garden and side dress. If the plants are already in and they're already growing, don't pile it up against the plant itself. Side dress, put it down the center of the row. Those nutrients will wash into the soil over time.
One of the things too is that I've heard of, you know, some of this compost going out, and when something that is thoroughly composted, you should not be able to determine what was in it. And I've heard that, you know, that people say, well, I can see the straw still left in the compost or the other type of vegetation, and you shouldn't be able to discern any of that. It ought to be just a nice dark black soil looking material. And so if you do see that, then as Peter said, continue composting it, and it'll take care of that. But that's been a problem.
Yeah, another indicator too, if there's any kind of sour or it doesn't smell good, you know, smells rancid, that's a sign it's not. Also, the little roly-poly insects, if there's a high concentration in the compost, that's just still, they're still there working on it. That means that it's not finished. You know, there should be some earthworms and a few insects, a few centipedes in the finished compost, but if you see a large concentration, particularly of the mealybugs or the little roly-polies, that's a sure sign that it's not ready to use.
More gardening advice coming up. Join us with your questions and comments, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and here to answer your gardening questions are co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Huttinger, and Boone County Cooperative Extension Horticulture Agent David Kester. You can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. We got an email from Peter, and he wondered what your thoughts were on diatomaceous earth, controlling flea beetles and other insects on eggplants.
I think it's fair. You know, they would be sprinkled on the foliage. The flea beetle crawls on it. I should get through that exoskeleton and be pretty effective.
It's somewhat effective. Flea beetles are tough. I mean, you can plant something like arugula as a trap crop, but the diatomaceous earth that can help particularly things like scaly insects and stuff, because it's basically microscopic shells that are very, very tiny, microscopic, and they kind of cut up the insect. You know, there was a concern once about them killing earthworms, but I did some research on that, and they said that if you're using moderate applications, that that shouldn't be an issue with worms and other, beneficial insects that are within the soil. But flea beetles, that's tough. You can use floating row cover to protect, and or shade cloth sometimes. The finer grades of shade cloth can also kind of keep it off to a certain degree. But at this point, I notice on my eggplants that the leaves are now coming in full. It seems the flea beetle cycle has sort of run its rotation, and it seems like we're kind of okay now.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us, and let's talk to Sylvia in North Avondale. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. You actually answered one of my questions about my peppers. They've just kind of stayed in time there, and so I did buy them probably after Mother's Day and let them sit probably a week and a half before I was able to plant them, and so they kind of just stayed the exact same. So I guess in the future, what I sounds like what you're saying to do is like loosen the root ball before I plant them.
Yes.
Or what would you recommend to make sure that they start to grow?
Well, yes, I think Peter, either that you buy a perfect transplant, which is one that is not root bound and that is just ready to go directly into the garden. You don't have to do anything to it. Or if there is one, you can just take your thumb, if you have fingernails, which I don't, but you can just kind of scratch down the side of that root ball, and just that'll just make and I would do it on each side of that, put it in the ground, water it, and it'll take right off. But just okay, separate those roots a little bit.
Another thing is that bigger isn't always better. If it's a big pot and a big plant and a small pot, you know, chances are it's root bound. And at the OFA conference last year, the Ohio Ecological Farm and Food Association conference, a friend of mine took did a workshop there, and they were talking about like how growth inhibiting a root bound plant is, and they're saying that you're much better off, you know, planting a smaller plant that's not root bound. That's why a lot of professional growers will start the seeds in small seed pots and then transplant them up to a 4-inch plant if they want to put it out later in the season, rather than allowing the plant to get root bound. So I think that's really crucial.
You know, I love to frequent garden centers that or greenhouses that will rotate their stock. And, you know, I don't want to go to a garden center on June 1st and maybe think I want to put in some late planting tomatoes and buy transplants that were ready there on May 1st. I would like to see a whole new shipment of transplants come in that were specifically grown to be planted on June 1st rather than ones that are just sitting around since May 1st.
Another thing, too, is that there's a number of growers now. There's independent greenhouses that are doing their own, plants propagation and start their own starts. And then also a lot of market gardeners are taking, bringing, particularly tomato and pepper plants to the farmers markets and growing them. And this is stock that, you know, they're sort of overrun, so to speak, but they're good plants. And these are plants that are often, even though they're not certified organic, they were probably no growth suppressants or no chemical fertilizers used on them. Primarily what most people are using is fish emulsion. So that's a really good source for your plants. I mean, if you go to a big operation, like these big box stores, I mean, you know, it's just it's kind of like a big cattle farm or something. I mean, it's the difference between grass-fed beef and, you know, feedlot beef. You know, keep that in mind. Go with your independence.
Sylvia, thank you for the phone call. We appreciate it. And as long as you're talking peppers, producer Pete Reitmeier had a question. He's noticed that the cardinals are eating his hot peppers. And he's wondering, is that common?
That says U of L cardinals, I think, is a problem.
No.
Now, I don't I have never known birds to eat peppers.
I've not seen that. I've seen them get in and peck at tomatoes because
moisture. Yeah. It may be just something specific to the Reitmeier property.
I think he grows good hot peppers. Maybe
I think he should take it personal.
Caroline emailed. She wanted to know if you could tell us again about that cocktail mix that you were recommending earlier. To use in overwintering the garden, and where you get that?
Yeah, there's different types of what they're called cover crops or green manure crops, and like David mentioned, winter rye. And winter rye you plant in the fall, and it kind of grows during the winter, and then shoots up during the spring. And that's a crop that has a very aggressive root system, and it's really great at crowding out weeds. And they say also there's an allopathic chemical in the roots that actually prevent weed germination. The downside is it's a lot of work to turn it in. And if you have a large plot, you're pretty much relegated to using a tiller. So if you wanted to do something that's more non-till, and I use winter rye sometimes for certain applications, it's excellent. But if you want to take something that's a little more passive, you're interested in lasagna growing, gardening, or no-till, these fall cover crop mixes are good. Like I mentioned, it's a mixture of different grasses, legumes, and often they have daikon radish in them, sometimes called tillage radish. And so that you plant that in the fall, it grows, and it completely dies back over the winter. So when you go into your garden, there's this dead mat. It almost looks like really like straw in a way. Yeah. And you can turn that in by hand, or else depending on what your crop is, you can, like say if you're doing beans or peas, you can drill right through it and plant it in the ground. It'll grow right up into it, and you have a mulch. And those are available right now. Hamilton County Soil and Water Conservation District is selling it for home gardeners. You can buy it by the pound. And that's Holly Ultrata Holcomb is the person that manages that program. And they also have you can buy soil testing kits for your garden too, which is, they have a really good price on that. And they will do follow-up consultation for you. So I hope that answered the question.
Christian emailed and he says he's thinking of buying 10 acres or so organic gardens, possibly sheep. His question is, how do you test the soil on that large scale to know if the entire area is in good shape for what they intend to do with it?
Well, you don't. You'd break that down into plot sizes, and I would do it that way. You really would go depending on if part of its pasture, part of its field crop, or whatever, you would do that. And then, of course, poorly drained areas, I'd do those separately. I'd do level ground, hilly ground separate, anything that you know has been treated a little bit differently. But really, your soil samples are so inexpensive to what the value of it is going to be that I wouldn't hesitate to take as many as you think you need.
And I think what Dave said, too, is really crucial. I mean, the needs of the soil for pasture is different than for vegetable crops. And then also, what are your plans? Are you going to be rotating vegetables through and pasture in a rotation? And so you got to think of your plan. But get on and get a Cage's topographical map, too, mm-hmm. which is really important. And then meet with your regional horticultural extension agent for advice.
Yeah, I think that's key.
And a baseline study of the site, too. Find out what has been going on there. I mean, was it a farm? But in some cases, at one point, if it was an apple orchard, you could have a lot of arsenic on the site because they used to use that in a lot of pesticides.
And if you're going organic, it's going to be 3 years from your first planting until you can actually certify that land as being organic. So you have to start doing organic practices from day one, but it'll take you 3 years before you can be a certified organic grower.
513-419-7100 to join us. Let's talk to Birdew. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you guys?
Good, thank you.
Good.
I have a question regarding centipedes in the soil.
Centipedes?
I have a plant. Yes, centipedes.
Okay.
I have a plant. It's a curry leaf plant, and I just noticed that a couple of days ago there is a centipede in it, and I have a dry soil, and I did the research. They said natural ways to do the DE, use the DE, and just put it on the surface and it should work. But my question is, they are underneath the soil. So how do I get rid of them? I mean, they wouldn't come up, right? Because of the light.
Why do you want to get rid of them?
I don't know. I think, like, you know, they will eat the roots or something.
They're organic. They don't eat live material. Yeah. And I mean, I guess it would be, if this plant was something as a house plant or something, you were going to bring it inside, there might, mm-hmm. you might, but I can't, I don't think there's any real problem with centipedes being out in.
Not unless there's a huge concentration, where I've seen people say that, like I talked about in compost, having the kind of little roly-poly bugs. I mean, people will say that they're eating the roots of my plant. What happens is that they put immature compost around their mm-hmm. plant, and the mealybugs are in there just doing their work, taking care of the compost, but disrupting the root fibrous fine roots of the plant because they're in there just doing their job. They're really not, by default, they're killing the plant. And so unless you have a huge concentration of them, I don't see it as a problem, particularly if it's a, you know, it's out in the soil in your garden. Mm-hmm. What you want to do is just to make sure if you add compost to your soil or make sure it's mm-hmm. fully composted and broken down. And then, okay. you know, maybe not. Sometimes people will top dress their garden with leaf mold, like crumbled leaves and things like that. And so, you know, the centipedes and these different insects will be in that leaf litter wanting to break it down like it's in the forest floor. So, you know, hold off doing that. If you want to use a mulch, maybe use pine fines or straw.
Birdew, thank you okay. for the call. We appreciate it. We got an Facebook question from Deborah, and she wants to know how to get rid of Creeping Charlie.
Boy, I'm assuming it's in a lawn. I mean, if it's in a garden, I mean, I hate to say it, but one of the best ways is just to get out there and pull and weed and cultivate shallow. I have to say there are herbicides that'll take it out pretty effectively. I know we can use plastic and
yeah. Well, you could try. Sometimes I've gone in because we have it on the edge of our yard, but we don't have a textbook yard that's full of a lot of things most people wouldn't want. But I go out there and mow it, and then I take it down, scalp it with a line trimmer, and then throw some grass seed in, and or else I have, in some cases, and where we're starting new garden beds, we have solarized. And this time of year is a good time. You put down a sheet of plastic mid-July, and then keep it, let it put bricks or logs or landscape fabrics around the edge, and let that bake for 6 weeks. And if often around the edge of the plastic, if you trench down, you know, like say 2 or 3 inches wide and 2 or 3 inches deep, that gets below the root runners, and then it really bakes it. And sometimes that'll help. And then you can go in and do a fall seeding of grass seed and hopeful that the grass would, you know, crowd it out. And right. One thing you can do for overwinter seeding grass, actually, if you use a little bit of winter rye in there, that'll act as what they call a nurse crop. And then in the spring, when you start mowing your grass, you'll cut off the winter rye and it dies back and the roots decompose as organic matter. And then you have your annual rye or your bluegrass or whatever in there.
Peter and David, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Co-owner of Home Meadows Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Huttinger, and Boone County Cooperative Extension horticulture agent, David Kester. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeyer was the producer for today's show. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Rick Andres was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. Just the year before NASA made its bold decision to launch the first flight to the moon, three astronauts had burned to death in their spacecraft. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll talk with author Jeffrey Kluger about Apollo 8, the mission that made the dream of walking on the moon seem within reach. We'll also hear about Odd McIntyre, the first modern pop culture reporter. That's Cincinnati Edition, Wednesday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.